This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
2007, from 9 to 11 p.m., and a special program from January 8, 2007, from 7 to 8 p.m. that Monday, and Tuesday, Earth 101, January the 9th, 2007, from 10 to 11:30 a.m. to participate in revolutionary radio, where the topic, the destructive power of religion, is explored in greater detail. It won't be the same without you. I'm Akua Fayette.
I'm OBDK Kamau of Self Determination.
Man that bled and suffered, and he hung on Calvary. And I want to thank him for how he brought me. And I want to thank God.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Walensky.
And Jennifer Renee.
I'm Deborah Bell.
And I'm Glenn Holt.
And I'm Ellis Arceleva.
And we have a real exciting show tonight here in midwinter here in Houston, Texas. We are going to talk about what's coming up this year by Lily Roddy, who is going to be our astrologer, our official Queer Voices astrologer. Talk about all the things that are going to come up by each different person. She does a monthly column in Outsmart, which is just out right now if you want to see what's in it. We're also
on it because the cover is quite hot.
Yes, oh. It is.
One for us women.
Yes. Finally, huh?
Yes.
And also Jeff Reed will be here from the Houston Equal Rights Alliance to talk about us also what's coming up in politics in 2007. We're also going to have This Way Out, and in the segment five, as we're calling it this week, the new director of operations at Pride Houston is going to be talking about the possible changes that's going to be happening to the parade and festival, both in the place where it is and the time of year it is. And we're going to open up the phone lines. Now, we don't usually do that here on Queer Voices, but this week it's going to be special, so that'll be about 9:20, so get your...
Yeah, do not call us before then.
Right, but get ready to call us at 713-526-5738.
And do remember to turn down your radio, because you'll just get feedback if you have it on, and if you say something we don't like, we'll hang up on you.
Right.
And we're not going to ask for money, just a piece of your mind.
But later this month, we'll be asking for money.
And in the full issue of disclosure, since I used to be working for Pride Houston, I will not be part of this segment.
All righty.
You're going to go call in?
No.
And tomorrow, the Texas legislature opens.
And it's a scary day.
And
yes.
It's a scary day.
Although there may be some interesting things.
Well, they're going to show the speaker selection on YouTube.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is great.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? And there was something else I wanted to say, but I can't remember what it is right now, but we're glad you're listening to us, and we're going to start off with the full version of the internationally syndicated program, This Way Out, which is done at KPFA.
KPFK.
Okay, I just get those KPFs.
A is in Berkeley. K is in Los Angeles. T is in Texas, as in Houston.
Oh, that makes
sense. W is in Washington, as in Washington.
Oh.
And for some reason, WBAI is in New York.
Okay.
Well, who knows?
The Pacifica family of stations. Yes, you're listening now to KPFT. So let's go this way. To the
out.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community. Following our holiday break, this report covers the 3 weeks ending January 6th, 2007. At least 21 churches around the United States have left the Episcopal Church USA, part of the worldwide Anglican Communion, and affiliated instead with the powerful anti-queer Anglican Primate of Nigeria, Archbishop Peter Akinola. Two large congregations in Virginia are among the latest to defect in recent weeks. The U.S. parishes, now members of Akinola's ultra-conservative Convocation of Anglicans in North America, oppose the Episcopal Church's consecration of openly gay New Hampshire Bishop Gene Robinson and its support for blessing same-gender relationships. Conservatives are also uncomfortable with November's elevation of Catherine Jeffers Chorey as the first woman presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church. That was also a first for the Global Anglican Communion, which has never before had a female priest leading one of its provinces.
In a late December interview with the New York Times, Akinola said the only time he knowingly touched an openly gay man horrified him. This man came up to me after a service in New York, I think, and said, "Oh, good to see you, Bishop. This is my partner of many years." As they shook hands, he recalled, I said, "Oh," and I jumped back. Akinola denies that he's violating Anglican rules that prohibit bishops from controlling parishes outside a bishop's territory. He says the convocation was formed to serve theologically conservative Nigerian Anglicans living in the U.S., and that it then began attracting conservative American Episcopalians. His growing power, Nigeria has more Anglicans than any other nation except England, is seen as a possible threat to the supremacy of the Anglican Communion's traditional spiritual leader, England's Archbishop of Canterbury, a post now held by Rowan Williams. Williams has been unable to quell the rumblings within the communion that erupted shortly before Robinson's consecration. The Anglican Communion is a confederation of national churches that have a total of 77 million members, more than 15 million of them in Nigeria. There are 26 million Anglicans in England, 8 million in Uganda, 5 million in Sudan, 4 million in Australia, about 2.5 million each in Kenya and in the United States, 2 million in Tanzania, 800,000 in Canada, 500,000 in New Zealand, and smaller numbers in several other nations.
Also making waves in the Global Anglican Communion, more than 50 gay and lesbian priests from the Church of England have registered their same-gender relationships under the Civil Partnership Act, according to Colin Coward, the director of a pro-LGBT group within the church. He told the Times of London this week that civil partnerships have helped to increase the stability of same-sex relationships and reduce the social exclusion to which lesbian and gay people are often subjected. But the news has outraged Anglican traditionalists. The Church of England's stance on same-gender relationships has been muddied by its Council of Bishops. In 2005, that body decided that clergy could enter civil partnerships as long as they informed their supervising bishops that they would refrain from sexual activity. Just how the no-sex rule could be enforced has also been unclear. According to the Times, Archbishop of Canterbury Rowan Williams is likely to face renewed criticism from primates of the Anglican Communion at a meeting set to take place in Tanzania in February.
Switzerland's first same-gender civil union took place this week. A gay male couple, one aged 89 and the other 60, registered their partnership in Locarno in the southern state of Ticino. The couple, who wished to remain anonymous, has reportedly been together for 30 years. The civil union legislation was passed by Switzerland's Council of States and the National Council in 2004. Because of the country's unique system of direct democracy, citizens who collect 50,000 signatures in 30 days can force a referendum on any new law. The Roman Catholic Church was instrumental in that effort, while Protestant churches generally supported the legislation. 60% of Swiss voters approved the new law, and it finally took effect on January 1st. That referendum was the first time in Europe that the issue of same-gender partnerships had been the subject of a national plebiscite. Swiss civil unions, however, do not grant full marital rights to gay and lesbian couples. They're barred from adopting children or from receiving fertility services.
The Czech Republic is reporting a surge in civil partnerships since they became legal there 6 months ago. More than 200 gay and lesbian couples have exchanged vows, according to a report this week by Prague Radio. LGBT civil rights leaders have been pleasantly surprised by the numbers. Jiří Hromada of the Gay Initiative said he had expected much less interest. The legislation, the first in a post-communist country in Central Europe to legally recognize gay and lesbian unions, gives couples who register their partnerships inheritance and health care rights similar to those given to heterosexual married couples. It does not, however, allow same-gender marriage or the adoption of children by lesbian or gay couples. The Czech Republic, which joined the European Union in 2004, is likely the most liberal of Eastern European countries. Recent public opinion polls show most Czechs support civil partnerships for same-gender couples.
But a civil union bill approved by Columbia's Senate died in the House of Representatives in late December. The bill would have set up a registration mechanism and granted same-gender couples in the South American country rights equivalent to marriage in the areas of Social Security, health benefits, pensions, and joint ownership of property. It passed the Senate in October by a 48-40 vote. According to the Bogota Daily El Tiempo, up until the last moment of the 2006 House session, the bill was on the agenda, but when it came time to vote, the quorum disintegrated. Colombian-born New York City queer activist Andres Duque lamented the cowardice of House members as incredibly disappointing, if not necessarily surprising.
A proposed constitutional amendment to end marriage equality in the U.S. state of Massachusetts is a step closer to getting on the 2008 ballot. Lawmakers voted on January 2nd, the last day of a special constitutional convention, to advance the proposed amendment, which defines marriage as the union of a man and a woman. Lesbi-gay activists were hoping the session would end without a vote, as it did when lawmakers recessed in late December. Amendment supporters, who collected more than 150,000 signatures to place the issue before legislators, would have been forced to begin the process all over again. The state's high court scolded the legislature in December for avoiding a vote on the citizen petition, but said it had no power to intervene. 61 lawmakers favored moving the amendment forward this week, while 132 opposed. Under Massachusetts law, the measure needed to be approved by at least 50 members of the current legislature and needs the support of at least 50 members of the new legislature before it can go on the 2008 ballot. The amendment does include language that existing same-gender marriages would remain legal. Mark Solomon, campaign director for Mass Equality, a queer advocacy group, criticized the prospect of holding a public vote on the rights of a minority. He also told reporters that 17 lawmakers who supported the amendment won't be returning in the new legislative session, and that 7 newly elected lawmakers will vote against it. About 8,000 lesbian and gay couples have wed in Massachusetts since the Supreme Judicial Court ruled in 2003 that the state constitution guarantees them the right to marry.
Alaska Governor Sarah Palin vetoed a bill in late December that would have prohibited the state from extending health care benefits to the same-gender partners of public employees. The measure was passed by the Republican-controlled legislature during a special November session in direct defiance of a state Supreme Court order. Palin, also a Republican, said she rejected the bill as unconstitutional, even though she personally opposes the benefits. "Signing this bill," she wrote, "would be in direct violation of my oath of office." Alaska's Supreme Court ruled last year that because state law bars same-gender couples from legal marriage, denying health care benefits to the same-gender partners of public employees violates Alaska's constitutional guarantee of equal protection for all its residents. In September, a Superior Court judge assigned to oversee details of implementation found that the regulations proposed by state lawmakers were too restrictive. They required, for example, that gay and lesbian couples certify being in a committed relationship for at least 12 months and document each year they are still together. The legislature then passed, and Palin signed, a bill that calls for voters to decide whether there should be a constitutional amendment denying benefits to same-gender couples. Palin said the measure, set for a special election on April 3rd, will be non-binding, but is intended to help guide legislators. LGBT rights groups say they will now focus on defeating that measure.
And finally, the highest court in the Canadian province of Ontario ruled this week that a 5-year-old boy can have 3 legal parents, 2 moms and 1 dad. In the landmark case, the Ontario Court of Appeals said the female partner of the child's biological mother could be legally recognized as the boy's 3rd parent. The biological father, named on the boy's birth certificate, is a friend of both women and is taking an active role in the child's life. The 2 women, who've been together since 1990, didn't want to use the adoption process to gain parental rights for the 2nd mom because, under current law, the father would then lose his legal status as a parent. One outraged conservative group called the ruling naked judicial activism, while another charged that it would open the floodgates to multiple parenting by committee. Mary Douglas of the conservative Christian-based Campaign Life Coalition warned that attacks on the family unit will ultimately lead to the destruction of our society. But the Family Services Association of Toronto worked with the applicant's legal counsel during the case, and the group's director of social reform, Laurel Rothman, praised the decision. She told reporters that the situation basically recognizes the changing face of families in Canada in the beginning of the 21st century.
That's News Wrap for the 3 weeks ending January 6th, 2007. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
A celebrity sheep farmer down under brings a hopeful message to queer and questioning youth in isolated areas. But first, This Way Out commentator Janet Mason reminds us that you never know what might happen while hailing a cab in New York.
I first became acquainted with Truman Capote when I was an adolescent in the 1970s, and he was a guest on the Dick Cavett Show. At this point, Truman was nearing the end of his career and his life, which was cut short at 60, and he was not in the best shape, but still, he was riveting. Growing up in a suburban tract house landscape, I felt like a freak, and was immediately drawn to Capote, his falsetto voice, his slicing barbs, his expressive hands, inching up behind his head and perching there like long-necked swans, yearning for flight. Soon, I was reading my way through In Cold Blood and then everything else he had written. Of his books, my favorite has always been his first novel, published when he was 24, entitled Other Voices, Other Rooms, a charming coming-of-age story full of the Deep South swamp-laced mysteries, race relations, and basic human strangeness, shown to us through the lens of the effeminate boy protagonist and his tomboy female friend, who we later come to know as Harper Lee. Hollywood, with the release of Capote and now Infamous, has brought Truman back into vogue, or perhaps has saved him from the great void. I actually have met younger people who, before the movies, were not only unfamiliar with his work, but had never heard of him. Truman Capote has always been more to me than a great writer, gay icon, or even genius, the word that he used to describe himself. When I was a young writer, Capote was a bridge to other writers, most notably to the great American novelist Willa Cather. Born in 1873, Cather spent much of her young life in the prairie country of Nebraska, which she would immortalize in O Pioneers and My Antonia. Several other remarkable novels of Cather's include Death Comes to the Archbishop, a brilliant portrayal of the galvanizing forces of the Southwest, and Song of the Lark, a portrait of a gifted opera singer. Truman Capote first met Willa Cather in 1942 when he was 18, and for a period of time, she became his mentor. He chronicled this first meeting in his collection of essays, now entitled Truman Capote, Literary Conversations. He was leaving the New York Society Library on East 79th Street. Snow was falling heavily, and he saw a woman standing on the side of the street looking for a taxi. He described her as mesmerizing, her eyes especially blue, the pale, brilliant, cloudless blue of prairie skies. But even without this singular feature, her face was interesting, firm-jawed, handsome, a bit androgynous. Pepper-salt hair parted in the middle, 65 thereabouts. A lesbian? Well, yes. In the snowstorm, there is no taxi to be found, and the woman suggested to him that the two of them go for a cup of hot chocolate. Not knowing who she was, Truman told Willa that he was a writer and had published several short stories and was working on a novel. When she asked who his favorite living American authors were, he replied that he really liked Willa Cather. Then he asked her if she had read My Mortal Enemy. Cather replied that she had written it, and a friendship commenced, with Truman spending many evenings in the Park Avenue apartment that Willa shared with her longtime partner, Edith Lewis. Known for her quote that the history of a country begins in the heart of a man or a woman, Cather is, in many ways, a writer's writer. Many people come to her work later in life. The reason for this is that she did not allow her work to be published in textbook editions, since she did not want young people to be forced to read her books. She wanted them to find the books on their own and to enjoy them. Had I met Willa Cather as Truman did on a snowy evening on East 79th Street, I would have been every bit the, quote, schoolboy, as Truman described himself when he was babbling about her books. Truman Capote has long been described as having gay pride before the phrase existed, and as a writer, his wide array of characters never excluded lesbians. There was the tomboy-girl characters, Idabel Tompkins, in Other Voices, Other Rooms, who he likens to another tomboy that his narrator had known. A beefy little roughneck who had lived on the same block in New Orleans, who had a habit of waylaying him, stripping him of his pants, and tossing them high into a tree. In Breakfast at Tiffany's, Holly Golightly makes numerous references to lesbians, all of which were removed from the movie version, which starred Audrey Hepburn as Holly. In the book, Capote cites Holly Golightly's preference for lesbian roommates as she says, "Of course, people couldn't help think I must be a bit of a lesbian myself, and I am. Everyone is a bit." Writers tend to write about themselves, even when they are writing about someone else. So I would say that this statement stands true for Truman as well as for Holly. His controversial last book, Answered Prayers, the unfinished novel, ends with his society matron character in La Côte Basque, the chapter named for the posh New York restaurant, envying the lesbian life of a friend of hers. In the end, Truman returned to thinking and writing about his old mentor. The last thing he wrote before his untimely death, caused by his addiction to drugs and alcohol, was 14 pages of a rough draft of an essay on Willa Cather. With commentary on queer literature and life, this is Janet Mason for This Way Out.
We were out in the country.
Doug Stevens.
And we're the Out Band,
the official gay and lesbian ambassadors of country music.
And you're listening to
This Way Out, the international
lesbian
and gay magazine.
Australians got to know David Graham as a leading contestant on that country's 2006 edition of Big Brother. For 3 months, the openly gay 27-year-old Queensland sheep farmer devoted much of his TV screen time to raising public consciousness about the issues confronting queer and questioning rural youth. As Graham's own story demonstrates, the only thing standing between many of these young people and suicide is the existence of LGBT community-supported telephone hotlines and counseling services. In an appropriately natural setting in the inner suburban New Farm Park along the Brisbane River and serenaded by a cornucopia of crows, This Way Out correspondent John Frame chatted with David Graham about the dangers of isolation and depression in rural areas and the unique role of telephone counseling in rescuing LGBT youth.
As you were growing up, living in the country and being isolated, it was a journey for you then to self-acceptance, to coming out as being gay.
Yeah.
A breakthrough for you was being able to get in touch with your emotions, especially to cry.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, we in the country, and ethnic people have got a similarity here, is that we are brought up, men are men and women are women. So that means that men have a set of rules that they have to live by and women have a set of rules that they have to live by, and there's no blurring of the lines. And one of the fundamental rules of being a male is you do not cry. You don't allow your emotions ever to leave your skin. And that was very powerful for me to realise that's not a rule that you have to live by. And as soon as you break that rule and accept tears as being a flow of energy that releases a problem or a knot or an issue that you've got within, suddenly that issue just dissipates and each tear just seems to drive away the angst that you have, you know, be it hitting your toe or realizing that you're gay. It's a powerful mechanism that we, over evolution, have created, whereby we can let go, and it's something that's very powerful, and I think it's something that's very wrong with our culture and any culture that suggests that the crying should be held back and should be allowed only for women. And I think something it says something to me, and I'm not a scientist or am I someone who studies people too much, but women find it okay to cry. They're told that it's fine to cry and it's okay to talk, and their suicide rates are about 5 in 100,000, whereas men have the suicide rates of about 20 in 100,000, and in rural areas and ethnic groups it's up around 35 in 100,000. So to me, I see a correlation there. I see a correlation between forcing men not to cry and not to talk about their problems, and the fact that there's a higher suicide rate. I see that as a complete... there's a connection there. And that's something that I've realised, because before, when I didn't cry, I was suicidal. Suddenly I no longer had any suicidal tendencies, let alone carried a problem from one day to the next. And I think, look, it's pretty simple, and I may just be a simple farmer when it comes to me explaining why we have a lot of problems: suicide rates, domestic violence, and general violence in our streets. But for me, it comes back to just allowing people to break those fundamental rules that we set on our children, and that is, if you're a man, you don't cry.
But with the process of talking, you suggested crying and talking are the two big things.
Yes.
Who do you talk to when you're a rural youth?
Dogs. Seriously, my dogs. And because I'm on a farm alone, and if you don't even talk to your dogs, I mean, you're stuffed. You're not crazy. You need to talk to someone. And look, I do talk to my dogs, and they do give me affection back, and they do lick my face, and in their way, that's saying, look, it's all right, Dave. Don't worry. That sheep, yes, he's giving you a hard time, but you know, we'll get him. We'll get him back to the mob. So yeah, no, look, I do talk to my dogs, and that's now, because it's a lot easier. But look, I have my mates, and thankfully we now have mobile coverage across my whole farm. So whenever I do have a drama, and especially during this severe drought, I'll have a drama at least once a day, and I'll just be like, oh, bugger this, you know, and I'll get onto the phone and call one of my mates, and now Sharif's moved up there, so, you know, I can just yell at him.
Right. But there is the Gay and Lesbian Telephone Counselling Service.
Yeah, I should have mentioned that when I was dealing with my sexuality, I did rely on them a lot. Not here in Queensland. It was when I was going to agricultural college down in rural Victoria. So I did, and that really did save my life. And for me, I really used the phone counselling service in my heaviest times, and that was when I was dealing with coming out. And without question, they saved my life. There is no reason that I'm here except for the phone counselling service. Not only do they have a certificate saying that they can give you phone counselling, but they've got life experience. And I also did a phone counselling course when I was in Victoria. That was my way of repaying the debt that I had. Everyone that I did my course through, and there was about 80 of us down in Melbourne, everyone had come from a really long journey. You know, and so they had life experience that you weren't just talking to someone with a piece of paper that said they could counsel, that said that they could give you that reflective counselling, which is so often the case with phone counselling services. With the gay and lesbian phone counselling, you really do get a person that has been there. And if they haven't been there, well, then in their circle of friends, someone has been where you're at, and they can empathise and sympathise and actually be in your shoes. And so you're talking to a person that knows 100% where you're coming from and really can help you. They're not going to give you the answers, but they understand where you're coming from. And it's so important that when you are reaching out for help, that you have someone that understands that you're not alone, and that you can feel as well that you're not alone going through your journey. And I think that's one of the hardest things for young people coming out, or even men and women that have gotten married and gone on through their lives, and you know, their kids are going through teenage years, they still feel like they're alone. And that's the best thing about the gay and lesbian phone counselling, is that you're not alone and you're talking to someone that's probably been in your situation.
Yeah. You were saying it's good to emote and talk, even if it's two dogs, but people should be aware also that there's a point at which you should really seek help, like seek medical help even about depression.
Yeah, there comes a point where, you know, the dog licking your face doesn't make the problem better. It doesn't make you go, oh, okay, cool, it's, you know, it's just a naughty sheep that keeps running back to the bush. You know, it's there is a point, and it's different for every single person out there, but whenever you feel like it is a serious thing to talk about, well, then that's when you pick up the phone and you speak to the counsellors at the Gay and Lesbian Counselling Service. But, yeah, it's different for every single person. For me, I waited until when I was at college, that someone else had committed suicide the night before, and I realised from the repercussions of that, and my suicide was planned for 2 days after that. So, I waited too long, I think, and I think that other people need to realise a little bit earlier, and whenever you're at that point where you think it is too much, that's when you pick up the phone.
That was Australian sheep farmer and Big Brother TV star David Graham in conversation with This Way Out correspondent John Frame in Brisbane, Queensland. Graham maintains a website at farmerdave.com.au. Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Sherry Lund, Rex Walker with Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, Janet Mason, and John Frame contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out anytime, exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also click on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Most This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from you, our listeners, and we thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air and choose from some special CD thank you gifts, too. You can email us at tworadio@aol.com or write to us at Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on 2YOU Tamworth, New South Wales, KOOP Austin, Texas, WJSC Johnson, Vermont, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
And we're just always dancing.
I like to
away.
Dance. Let's yeah. just dance, dance,
that,
dance.
When that music plays, we just have to chair dance.
That's right.
Yeah.
Flash dance.
Yes. Oh, get off that pole, Jennifer. Well, this is Deborah Bell along with Jennifer Renee. And
that's me.
It's the beginning of the year, and I'm sure if you're like me, you want to know what the stars have in store. And we are very fortunate to have with us the ace astrologer from Outsmart, Lily Roddy. In this month's edition, her column is called Heavens to Lily.
Heavens to Lily.
And it outlines
very nice picture.
More detailed information for each of the signs. Despite the fact that there's a slight error in the artwork, it's beautiful artwork, but it doesn't necessarily have the correct symbol with the correct sun sign.
But I understand that the words and the all of that is correct, right?
We're hoping for that to
okay.
be true.
Well, what did losing Pluto, how did it affect our signs?
It didn't affect us at all.
Oh, good.
And we still have Pluto and we still use it, and primarily because astrologers have used the asteroids and other points, you know, for, you know, decades.
More than decades.
A day or two.
It's been around a long time.
Well, it has.
I mean, back from ancient days, that's how the signs even got named.
The Persians, the Greeks.
Well, but we use the asteroids, which haven't really been implied in for a while.
Yeah.
But the other planets, yes.
But do astrologers still consider Pluto a planet?
Yes, we do.
Okay. And do you have a question or a message for Ellie? Oh, she's just trying to make sure that our technical...
My mic is her.
Right. Thank you.
So we can hear you.
Yeah, oh, good.
And let's just start off with what you feel like we need to tell folks.
Okay. Well, I think the very first thing that I would like to talk about is that... the people ask me the most about is Mercury retrograde, and I want to cover those dates. The first thing, and to say is that Mercury, which is a planet that represents communication and automobiles, electrical things, goes retrograde 3 times a year. Now, retrograde doesn't mean that things are bad. It just means it's a good time for personal review of whatever topics that come up. And Mercury naturally goes retrograde 3 times a year. So the first retrograde is from February 11th through March 11th. The next one is from June 12th through July 13th. And the third one is from October the 8th through November the 3rd. And during those times, it's the best time is to review what you're doing, if you're clean up things and clean up any sort of mess that you have. And oftentimes during retrogrades, things that have been that were done improperly come to the surface, and that's the time we should fix them.
Now, what does the term retrograde really mean?
Retrograde means, in this traditional sense, is it means that the planet appears to move backwards against the signs of the zodiac.
How does that happen?
That tells me that's not
what's happening. It's an illusion, right?
Yes, it represents, and actually represents, whatever planet is retrograde, it represents a conjunction between the Earth and that planet. And that happens with all planets, actually.
Okay, and
except
of course,
the sun, of
Mercury
course.
Is the planet closest to the sun.
Exactly,
right.
And it's moving fast. It takes 88 days to go around the sun, which is why we have so many retrogrades.
I see. And isn't one of the aspects of it is that communications often get mixed up, or are there certain things that are problematic?
Exactly. That's one of the key things, and that's the reason why we say is not to start new things, or, you know, particularly don't install a phone system or, you know, buy a computer during those times, because you'll certainly regret it.
I see.
Don't get married under those times.
When Mercury is retrograde, do not get married.
Unless you've made the mistake of marrying the same person twice, then it's okay.
I see.
Well, my first two marriages were in retrograde. No wonder.
That explains everything.
Well, the third one was too. God.
So we must make.
Next time I'll ask you.
We must make note that when a same-sex marriage does become legal, as it should everywhere, that we must still not get married during
retrograde.
Okay. So what is the other what's the big news for 2007?
Well, the big news is that. That's a really interesting question. Thanks. The big news is actually that there's been an alignment of two particular planets, Saturn and Neptune, and they've been opposing each other in the sky really since the latter part of 2006. And this has really created a very repressive sort of atmosphere that we've been living in. And and it was
the Bush administration.
Something like that. And
Perhaps
shrub has something to do with it.
Being that Saturn rules my sign, that might explain maybe all these people I've been dealing with are in have Neptune ruling theirs, and that's why there's been.
And so part of that is to sort of relieve us of some of the deceptiveness that's been going on, and that's what's particularly strong. We saw that at the end of '05 when we saw some of this, and also in '06. And as long as this is sort of in play, it's sort of the purpose is to keep people's real, you know, is to keep communications and every image real. But it also has a tendency to sort of squash people's optimism and enthusiasm, which is why we had sort of a very sad or not as, you know, sort of joyous holiday period that we had. A lot of people I talked to were not, going out or buying lots of gifts or whatever people do for the for those holiday periods.
Mm-hmm. So, I guess what everyone, you know, the big question for most individuals is, what's up for their sign?
That's right. What about me? That's, yep. that's the
and
most
by
important
the
thing.
Way, next Monday, which is the 15th of January, we are having a collective celebration of my birthday, which is the 16th, Jack's birthday, which is the 11th, Glenn's birthday, which was in December, and our friend Jimmy Carper also is a Capricorn birthday.
Oh, that's right.
Now, interestingly enough, Howard Stern and Rush Limbaugh also are Capricorns. And, of course, we have to remember that today, being Elvis's birthday, that Elvis was a Capricorn. So, where
thank
do you
thank
start?
You very much.
That was good.
That's very
thank
good.
You. Thank you very much. Elvis died on the throne, so we don't have to. Okay, I stole that from Larry Winters. It's all right.
Oh, you should give it back.
Oh. Okay, let's let Lily get on with what she's here to do.
Now, more about us.
As you look at the astrological wheel, or the sky wheel, I think it's often called. Yes, you have the diagram right there. Where do you start on that? January is the beginning of the year, but it's not the first sign on the...
No, the first sign that we normally start with is Aries, and that's because it's on the eastern side of the sky. And so we just begin with the east because that's where the sun rises. And since we're light beings and drawn to all things light, then we're drawn to that particular sign first. So this year for Aries, it's actually a very interesting year. There's a lot of interest in terms of them expanding and growing and not sort of staying in the same place that they have been in a long time. The only problematic areas that Aries really will encounter this whole year has a lot to do with their own friendships and organizations that they belong to. That can be a very testy time for them, and a lot of that depends on them wanting to get more from what they're doing, and there could be a sense of separation from friends and people that they've been associated with a long time. Also, particularly Aries that have children, this can also be a problematic year because children are sort of wanting to be more adult-like and take on more responsibility, which is fine if they're 30, but if they're, you know, 7, then that can be definitely much more problematic. And overall, there's also a necessity for Aries to pay a lot more attention to their health and to improve their overall health conditions, which are not necessarily an Aryan thing to do. Aries people much prefer just to enjoy their lives and to move forward, and that's what they usually do. And there's also a shift in their own spiritual awareness that's going on, the sort of more of an undercurrent thing. And most Aries are being drawn to sort of reinventing their own spirituality this year. That's another part of that, which is not always seen about Aries. Aries people are very... The sign Aries is really a sense of pure spirit, really unencumbered by things around at the earth or anything else. It's which is why Aries people are so spontaneous and you know, incidentally
Aries,
irritating.
Aries is ruled by Mars?
Mars, the planet Mars.
All right. And next, that brings us to Taurus.
The lovely sign of Taurus.
April 20th through May 20th.
Oh, thank you for reading those dates. Taurus people, their difficulties are going to arise mostly in the home and career sectors of their lives. A lot of right now, particularly Tauruses, are really trying to figure out what their career path needs to be. A lot of Tauruses are really struggling with that, and because they're being called upon to do something that fulfills them from an internal perspective rather than an external perspective. And at the same time, they're sort of being challenged by their own core belief systems and issues they brought with them from childhood, which is shifting the way they look at things. and making them want to ask what do they really want out of their life. In such, in many ways, I would say a much more spiritual approach to life rather than sort of the mundane approach that generally Taurus runs into. However, this is a really exciting year for Taurus, for friends and associations and groups and things like that, because they're really sort of breaking out of this sort of internal period that they've been in. And relationships are a bit touchy for Tauruses, because they're wanting more than they've had in the past, and they're also trying to be more open about their own communication. Not always an easy thing for a Taurus.
Like I heard in a song, "You want more than I'm willing to give."
Exactly. And Tauruses do, and in a sense, Tauruses do usually assume a lot about things and can, in that sense, be sort of possessive. But this year, they're really trying to struggle and be more open and allow a greater interaction in their relationships.
Okay, and then we have May 21st through June 21st,
that's
which
Gemini.
Gemini. Which my wonderful oldest son is a Gemini.
Well, and I thought I might comment on the symbol of Gemini just for fun, is that the Gemini actually comes from the symbol of the Roman numeral 2, which is what the symbol is, and it represents that duality, which is just so obvious in so many Geminis. The first half of the year is really a busy and active year for Geminis. First of all, the relationship area of the Geminis chart is highly charged. So if Geminis are single, this is really a good time to get out and meet people, because they're going to certainly have sort of their sexual magnetism is going to be turned up real high. And at the same time, in current and existing relationships, Geminis are really wanting to make sure that that their existing relationships are going well. If they're not going well, there's not a lot of tolerance for that, and there can be some breakups for some of those Geminis, particularly in May and in October, because they're really sort of wanting not to be bound by routines and things like that. And from a career perspective, this is really a year for Geminis to sort of change and really do exactly what they want, often in a much more sort of open-minded, high-tech field, or doing something that's really gives their brain a chance to work.
Wow!
So it's a very dynamic time.
Good year for
it. It does, but the very last third of the year, then Geminis are needing to be a lot more grounded. So there's a lot of experimentation through the first two thirds of the year, but the last third of the year, then Geminis have to sort of be more grounded, which won't be so easy for them.
Hmm. All right, and then in the summertime, as it continues, we
and the living is easy.
Yes.
June,
the fish are jumping and the cotton is high.
Oh, June is busting out all over.
Yeah.
June 22nd through July the 22nd is Cancer.
That's right. The lovely Cancers.
The crab.
The crab. You know, they hold on and they never
the
let go.
Child.
Okay. Generally speaking, this is really the first two-thirds of the year. This is really the year for the Cancers to sort of get their financial situations in order and to make sure that that whatever kind of old financial problems that have been dogging them are to really sort of take care of that and to get focused on that. After that, they're probably not going to be as focused on that, particularly by the time we get to September. And in relationships, there's really a great need for Cancers to have a much closer bonding process with whomever may be their partner or partner-to-be. And even in friendships, even for Cancers this year, really having someone that they can really talk to and be open about and talk about really deep and interpersonal needs are very strong for Cancers this year. This is also a great year for Cancers to be taking classes, traveling, really breaking out of a lot of their old routines, because it's really a necessity. And even for some of the Cancers, this is a time to sort of change work locations, not necessarily to change career, but maybe to even look for different opportunities at different places for their work. And that should be really, I mean, it's a good year for Cancer, but a lot of work, but a lot of good results on the other side of that at the same time.
Next comes Leo. July 23rd through August 22nd.
The lion.
Oh, it's my ever favorite lion.
Ooh.
Ooh, that was pretty good. Okay.
So, what's in store for the lion?
Okay, well, this has been a tough 2 years for the Leos, and we're going to have one more year of that. And that's because our good friend Saturn, planet of responsibility, structure, duty, and discipline,
ooh,
all those great things that we like, are is moving through the sign of Leo, and it will be finished in September. And so Saturn's about sort of making Leos think ahead, plan for the future, and sort of giving them a no-nonsense kind of way to tolerate life. And anything that doesn't really pertain to that Leo's life directly or doesn't really respect them, then a lot of Leo people are sort of, again, cutting, ending relationships and potentially eliminating some friends out of their life. But definitely they're planning ahead for the future more than they have in the past. Relationships are very dicey for Leos this year. Again, similar aspect is that they're really looking for a much deeper and spiritual insight into their own personal relationships. And they're wanting their relationship to be much more well-defined than it has been in the past. And the sad part about some of the aspects of Leonian people is that there's an element of betrayal and abandonment that often goes along with the Leo issue. So part of that is that the Leo person has to be much more upfront and be much more conscious about what they really want instead of assuming that other people are going to figure that out. So, and that also sort of plays into their own choices about career paths and things like that. And further on into the year, then Leos get much more attuned to sort of their financial needs and money needs, and that'll be happening after September.
Yeah. Then if you were born August 23rd through September the 22nd, it's Virgo.
That's right, the lovely virgin of the zodiac.
The virgin, oh yes.
Like you'd know.
Well, I've been at Virgin at least twice.
Okay.
Don't let us stop.
No,
don't let us
bother you.
Well, you know, it's us.
Okay. We're all friends here.
Okay, well, let's talk about relationships for Virgos. That's a good place to start. The planet Uranus is activating the relationship sector of...
Yeah, it's okay.
It's okay. Just a big silence over here on this other end.
We're just having fun over here.
And whenever Uranus is in the relationship sector, it's a necessity to either renew that relationship or there's a tendency to sort of toss it out. It certainly doesn't like boredom. And it really wants a lot more excitement brought into the relationship. So it can be, a sort of a struggle time, but a great time to meet new people, really breaking old patterns for Virgos in that particular way. Family. This is a very interesting year for Virgos because there's a lot of struggle with their own family, where they're really sort of cutting their own sort of past emotional history with their family and really sort of eliminating the parts of their life that they don't want to carry. In a way, this is sort of like I sort of refer to this as sort of the cosmic enema process within your own family, sort of getting rid of the toxins.
And I have to say it, that's why Uranus is
so prevalent in the sign.
Exactly. And so there's a real sense of clearing things out, and it hasn't been very easy for the Virgos to really be very clear or very organized, although the majority of the middle part of the year for Virgos, things seem to be much more upbeat, and they seem to be doing a lot better and sort of getting out of some of the depression that they've been in. And then that shifts in September when they're sort of driven to sort of get back into reality and do something more with their own lives. And it's a much more career-driven time, especially the latter half of the year for Virgos, which I think they'll find a lot better and a lot more stabilizing, since that's not really been the case for the most of the time.
Well, my favorite sign, Libra, which covers September the 23rd through October 23rd.
Is there any?
Which happens to be my birthday, October
2nd. Here. That's right.
Yes.
Many of my lovers have been Libras.
Oh. Well, anyway. What about Libras?
What about Libras? Okay. For Libras, I think I want to talk about this. There's a real need to sort of to totally revolutionize their work environment, the people that they interact with, and can be a real big shift in the work environment itself, changing the people that they work with or bringing in new equipment, and oftentimes just a change in their own personal habits, becoming a lot more conscious about what they eat, what they put in their body. This is in some ways a necessity for Libras to pay a lot more attention to their own health at this particular time. They could have some very quirky health problems this year, particularly related to blood sugar or lymph nodes, things like that. That can also come. I'm sorry to sort of mention those things.
Oh, thank you. Well,
but that is part of all this that's going on. Another side of the Libra part is that they're taking more account of their own friends now. Libra people tend to be much more concerned with interacting with people, just in a necessity of establishing relationships. And this year, the Libra people have been so much more, or supposed to be so much more, discriminating about whom they choose to let into their life. And again, there's part of this elimination of some of their old friends, redefining some of their long-term goals, especially with people that they relate to. And this would be more associates rather than romantic relationships in that area. And but it's still a good time for Libras to sort of be engaged in relationships, and particularly in personal relationships where it's a lot more playful, a lot more fun, and not so much seriousness around that.
Okay, we're closing in on the latter part of the year here, and we have 6 minutes, 5 minutes. So on to Scorpio.
Okay. Scorpios and Tauruses are experiencing similar issues in their life. This year, Scorpios are definitely reviewing their long-term goals in relationship to their work and their career. And for their home and family, there's a big separation process that's going on there. And I would expect that to continue through that whole time. As the Scorpios get to the more latter part of the year, there's a sort of a redefining of their community associations and goals, and on some level a greater need for more playfulness for Scorpios, which they don't always have. And I'll just keep going and on to Sagittarius. This year Jupiter, the ruler of Sagittarius, has moved into Sagittarius, and part of this means that Jupiter, the Sag people, are much more exuberant and open and wanting to do new fun things and travel, and you know, there's just a very magnetic sort of time for them. And really, the first two-thirds of the year, it's a really great time for Sagittarius to do things that they haven't done before, go back to school. If you're in a relationship, this is a great time for it. If you're single, this is a great time to meet new people. Family issues still are sort of gnaw at the Sagittarians, but they'll sort of come to grips with that as they approach September, when they become sort of more in charge with that part of their life, where they also become more focused on their career direction.
Capricorn, which is December 22nd through January 19th.
Those poor Capricorns.
There's so much going on with them.
Oh.
The Capricorn people, I sort of want to extend this. I just actually want to say this about Capricorns. Pretty soon, starting at the end of the year in August, Pluto is going to make its way into Capricorn. It hasn't been there in 248 years,
it's about time
for it to come around again. And this is what this is going to do. This is a big purging process for Capricorns. And so we're going to see Capricorns having, you know, massive garage sales and throwing things out in the street and getting rid of people that they don't like, because their tolerance level is going to be zero.
I can see a garage sale of people.
That's right. And part of this is that energy is sort of building now.
So what happens when they took Pluto out of being a planet?
Well, Pluto just went down to the corner for a cup of coffee.
That's right.
200 years later, it's getting
stronger. So this is sort of a transitional year for Capricorns to sort of get themselves prepared for a massive life change coming up in August. And that could be change in terms of career, relationships, to spin the wheel and choose a category on that one.
Okay.
And
Aquarius, January 20th through the February 18th.
This is a big spiritual time for Aquarians as they're really trying to consider the direction that they want to take them their life. A lot of them have sort of pulled away from day-to-day activities and are really almost in sort of a hermit kind of modality. On the other side of this, is they're probably feeling a lot of pressure from their relationships and their partners because they're struggling to put everything together and to try to give organization to their life. And then, do I do Pisces real quick?
Yep.
Do you have enough time?
Close off with the Pisces.
Okay, and Pisces, this is your year. This is the year to be a Pisces, change life direction, step out of that sort of wanting to help everyone and step into wanting to be your own individual self. Great career opportunities are just on the horizon. If you don't like your job, get out there and find something new. New people will be drawn to you. It's an exciting year to be a Pisces.
And before we top it off, I'm just going to say once again, we've had Lily Roddy, who's an astrologer and writes a monthly column in Outsmart magazine, which is currently at different community locations, businesses, and also online. Outsmartmagazine.com. Why is August, September time of year? What's happening that's going to... You mentioned it several times.
Well, it's at that time of the year that that Saturn moves into Virgo, and whenever a planet changes signs like that, it creates sort of a disturbance. And then Pluto is about to change signs, which doesn't change signs for 13 to 14 years at a time normally.
Oh. And so that's bringing on some of these life examination and changes kinds of things. Well, thanks so much for being with us on Queer Voices. Is there anything you want to close with?
Well, I just wanted to say thank you for having me back every year to come and talk. I really have a great time, and it's just great to share what I do.
Give us your website one time.
www.lilyroddy.com, and you can contact me there or email me at lilycath@aol.com.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way. Part of the brother, I try so hard.
from the TV show The L Word, Season 3, that was So Jealous, and the artists were Tegan and Sarah. This is Queer Voices.
You know, sometimes I think we ought to retitle our show to be Queer Voices in Politics.
Yes.
Because we talk about politics all the time. Because it's a very, well, besides the fact that a whole bunch of us are political animals.
Yes.
But it's such an important thing in our lives. And everything from electing judges, which many people don't think is all that important, to electing president. I mean, you know, look at where we are in our country right now because of the president that's elected or been, you know, whether he was elected or not, that's a whole other thing, but you know, I think history is going to show he's the worst president ever.
Well, he's doing his fair share to make it that way, for
of course.
Sure.
On the Daily Show, they says, no, he's not the worst president ever, he's the worst president of the United States ever, because probably the worst president of an organization was the president of the Selena fan club. She shot Selena.
On that note, we have with us Jeff Reed of Hera, come to talk to us about 07 and what's going to be happening in politics.
Yeah, so I...
Welcome.
I was just very struck by, in the aftermath of the election, we were all so relieved, excited, and just, you know, gratified.
And surprised.
And surprised, yeah. To see things, you know, finally kind of going well for the GLBT community. But, you know, since then, some time over the Christmas break, and I think the realization has started to hit that there has been a huge reorganization, kind of at every level, really. And we are going to see a lot of the repercussions of that play out over the coming years, so I wanted to kind of discuss with two of my favorite political animals here.
Well, and the interesting thing is in Frank Rich's column yesterday in the Times, he says, I don't think the president actually realized there was an election upset because he's just going forward with some of his crazy things.
Right. Well, you know, he famously is not well known for being able to take the will of the people into consideration in his decisions. He is someone who, and you know, he was billed as this, so people who voted for him, you know, caveat emptor, that's what you bought, is a guy who follows his gut no matter what the facts on the ground are. But I don't think he realizes that he is possibly the earliest lame duck president in U.S. history. And, you know, this is why we're seeing this kind of crazy acceleration of the presidential race. I can't remember, you know, a year like 2007, end of 2006, really, where how many people just jumped on the bandwagon and started announcing that they're forming their presidential search committee, which, you know.
Well, and also the reality is that this is the first time in a long, long, long time that the vice president or the president isn't running for...
Right, and that's a really good point. I mean, Cheney's approval rating is, you know, what, 5%? I mean, the only people who like him are evil robots, basically.
And his lesbian daughter.
Yeah, and his lesbian daughter.
And his hunting partners.
I don't think they like him much anymore.
Well, the ones he hasn't shot.
The ones he hasn't shot probably are very gratified by that. But yeah, so, you know, and it's... The thing that I think is sort of fun to see is, like, Mitt Romney is a great example. You know, here's a guy, he's governor of Massachusetts, he's a Republican, and he made all sorts of statements, even in print, saying things like, you know, he supports civil unions, he supports gay equality, he supports the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. Well, you know, now he's doing this strange about-face, and all of a sudden he's trying to be the most, you know, red state guy who just happened to be in a blue state kind of coat, and, you know, people aren't buying it. And it'll be really, really fun to watch the people on the right eat their young on this one. They are going to go after Mitt Romney like you would not believe. The guy's a Mormon, which is not exactly on the same page as most of the Christian right, although politically they tend to align.
He's not a real Christian.
Exactly. And, you know, you're going to hear that over and over again. And, you know, his gay rights record is going to play out, and it's just going to nail him. But the question is then, well, you know, who do we get? I mean, you know, Giuliani, sure, he's a saint because of 9/11, but where was he when the two towers were hit? I mean, he was living, you know, because with his two gay friends in Manhattan, because his wife had essentially kicked him out of the house. So he doesn't exactly have the best in the credentials in terms of the far right. And then, you know, of course, on the Democratic side, we have the big monster of Hillary kind of looming down everything with Barack Obama feeling the waters. So it certainly promises to be very interesting at the national level, but also at the local level, like at the presidential race, we have this confluence of events with Shelley Sekula Gibbs managing somehow to be the losingest winner of a race that I've ever seen.
Interesting way you put that. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, she basically lost the seat she had to take another seat for 2 weeks and then managed to alienate
everybody in Washington
including,
in 2 weeks.
Including Tom DeLay. You know, when Tom DeLay's staff says that you're impossible to work for, that you have done something wrong.
Well, I think there might have been some ulterior motive there, because those people may want to run themselves, or they may want to work for somebody else in 2 years, hoping to get rid of which will be an incumbent.
Right.
Then.
And certainly, you know, I mean, Nick Lamson probably would, you know, is feeling the heat now that she essentially is a done deal, and she's an easier candidate for him to face than many. But it opens up such a bizarre kind of circumstance on city council where, you know, we now have the mayor saying, well, I don't want to hold an election because it's going to cost the taxpayers money, but the legislature would have to sign off on that, and it may or may not happen. And, you know, everybody from the leader of the local log cabin Republican group to, you know, people like Noriega, who, you know, you sort of expect to run for council, are kind of coming up for this short-term seat. And then, you know, Ada Edwards is up, and Michael Berry is up, and there's a couple other seats that are up, you know, in the coming year. And so then there's going to be a real reorganization, but again, in the context of a far more democratic world where, you know, Houston is becoming more democratic, and in general, this repudiation of the Republican platform is causing a real kind of earthquake, and it's certainly something to watch and marvel at.
So, how do we do all this stuff? How do we move forward and continue the momentum of what has happened? You know, it's one thing to win an election, but it's another thing to govern.
Yeah, that's very true. And, you know, one of the problems with our form of government is the qualities that you want in someone who is a good candidate is not always the qualities that you want in someone who actually is going to govern. And, you know, just to give a little shout out to one of our favorite people, Anise Parker is a perfect example of someone who is an excellent governor. She's an excellent candidate, but she also is really good and invested in the business of governance. And so I think as a community, the thing that we do is we find those candidates who are good on both ends, and we really support them, because when people like Anise win, it makes fair-minded people who maybe haven't had a lot of contact with gay people stand up and say, oh, well, you know, she's nice and she's effective, and that reflects really well on all of us. So it behooves us to find candidates who represent us well, and to hold the candidates that we have elected and who are in our community to the fire, and make sure that they continue to represent us well and govern us well.
Well, and I guess that was sort of like Craig Washington. He was considered a very good candidate, but when he got to Congress, it wasn't quite as well as we hoped. Although, if I was a betting person, I would bet that Ellen Cohen is going to turn out to be a great.
Yes, I agree. I mean, Ellen Cohen, she was such a good candidate in part because she had such deep credentials running the Houston Women's Center, and you knew that she could run something big. This wasn't a big leap for her. She wasn't going from, you know, some sort of corporate job. She was already involved in public life to such a degree that you know, it will be really exciting to see her step up. And to go further with the state level stuff, back to this theme of the big changes they are coming, you know, with Craddock as Speaker, he ruled with such a heavy hand, and, you know, going after Republicans who didn't toe the line on vouchers, famously, with Landinger's money. I think that it's going to be very interesting to watch what happens at the state level. I think that we're going to see a serious fight, and Jennifer, actually, before we came on air, was saying that, you know, this race is really turned out to be already interesting.
And I understand that it's going to be webcasted on YouTube. If I thought I heard that, maybe I heard that, I don't know. But
well, the most interesting question is, can they do a public vote? Because historically, they can choose how they elect their own leaders, and it has been done by private vote, of course.
Well, I had understood it's an instantaneous vote. They all sit there, and then they all push at the same time to vote for it. Now, is that true?
Right, but the question is, can you tell who voted what way? That's the big question. Is that open information? Can Craddock go after the vote and look down the list and see who voted for him and who didn't? Because if he can...
Well, if they push the button, it's lit up on the board.
Well, but so there is a move in the legislature done mostly by friends of our community, I think, to try to get the speaker vote to be a private vote. It was mentioned on Vern Orange Report, but several other political observers have pointed out that they feel that Craddock cannot hold the House speakership if there is a private vote. If it's secret ballot, he will not win because there are so many people who are mad at him. But they wouldn't risk him winning and then losing their plum committee assignments.
Oh, yeah, he'd beat them to death.
Yeah, and he's exactly the kind of guy who would do that. This is not a softball kind of guy. So my prediction is that actually he probably won't keep the seat, mm-hmm. even if it's a public vote, because he's been so damaged by this. But it's very close, and he very easily could. It's not a done deal.
And you know, all this talk about the game of politics and all the stuff that's going on, but how all this happens is through the grassroots effort.
That's a good point. I mean, I come on here, and I'm always thinking about sort of, you know, the kind of theory of the thing, but Jack's point is well taken. You know, the stuff that makes these changes happen, the reason we have interesting theoretical possibilities, abstract ideas to think about and talk about here, is a whole lot of people did an enormous amount of really laborious and unsexy work, like calling people they don't know and asking them to vote for Hubert Vaux, or calling people they don't know and asking them to vote for Ellen Cohn, or block walking in neighborhoods they've never been in, talking to people that they don't know and would never see in their regular life and saying, hey, here's a candidate who's running in your district, and you know what, I really think they're great, and I really support them, and I think you should too. That's the kind of thing that puts Craddock on the run, that makes Mitt Romney uncomfortable when he has to tack to the far right. That's the sort of thing that makes all of this happen. And
You know, not that any of us have any stake in this. Actually, we all do.
Yes.
Especially here at the table. If you're interested in volunteering with either the Houston Equal Rights Alliance or the Houston GLBT Political Caucus, you can show up this Saturday at our new offices, which is at 1915 Commonwealth, Suite 104. It's at the corner of Commonwealth and Welsh. There is street parking and some parking behind the building. So there's no excuse if you can't find a parking space. If you're interested in getting involved in some of that, and that's stuff like entering stuff in the database, we won't be making any calls this weekend, but we'll be gearing up to be doing that, you know, in a few weeks. And
there's always a place for volunteers.
Absolutely.
Always. And just to go back to what Jeff was saying a moment ago, the grassroots, doing those things is all the reason that Ellen Cohen is replaced Martha Wong, and Hubert Vaux is back in the legislature after Heflin came after him, gay baiting and all this, because of the grassroots efforts of our community and other people. So volunteers are essential.
And you can find more information out at HoustonERA.org or HGLBTPC.org.
I would also real quick like to echo one thing that Jack said. If you are a GLBT person, you have a unique investment in the political system that we live under, because that is the only way that we have ever managed to obtain any of the rights that we have, and it's the only way we're going to get more. So if you don't do it, shame on you.
The shame is that we have a constitution that promises all of us equal rights, but yet we've had to fight to support our own rights.
And coming up after some music, we are going to be opening up the phone lines because we have the new director of operations for Pride Houston, and he's going to be talking about some possible changes for 2008 of possibly moving the parade and festival and also the time of year that the event happens. You're listening to Queer Voices. Hard to be sure.
that your thoughts are what you believe. I know it's hard sometimes to be living. Too many people are so insecure. Mistakes are easy to make, but now is the time for us to be giving. Just free your mind. All of the same. People are crying out through their sorrow. Crossing the line to show that you care isn't always easy to do, but we have to pave the way for tomorrow. Yeah. Just free your mind.
That was Matt Clark with Free Your Mind from the album Free Your Mind.
This is Queer Voices.
And here on Queer Voices, you hear the queer voice of Jennifer Renee.
Yes.
And Deborah Bell. And we're having a new queer voice on Queer Voices. And this is Jeffrey Cuellar, who is the new director of operations for the Houston Pride Committee.
And we are going to open up the phones tonight to take phone calls.
Only so after that, we have a little talking
well,
first.
Well, yes, so. But they could go in and call in. I wanted to give them the number.
If they want to be in the queue.
That's
what's that
right.
Number?
713-526-5738.
That's the same number we're always giving you when it's...
And you don't have to give money this time.
But if you want to, we'll gladly take it.
Yeah, well, yeah. Just give us a piece of your mind.
Yeah.
If you can spare it.
Yeah, alrighty. And, so this year, after another fabulous Pride month of June and the wonderful nighttime parade and a really outstanding festival, some changes took place within the Pride Committee, some personnel changes, and also a task force. I don't know exactly how the task force came about, except that it's through a firm that donated consultants.
It's a firm called Accenture.
Yeah. And are those the people that messed up the children's insurance program in Texas?
I do not know.
I believe that's the case. But the task force was gathering information. One being at the parade and festival day, and the insulting term "man on the street" interviews. How did they know? during the Pride Parade with them. And they
should not be gender specific.
They also did
person on the street.
One-on-one in-depth interview with stakeholders, that being organizations, political leaders, and businesses, and one-to-one in-depth interviews with potential information resources, including other Pride festivals throughout the world, city resources, and other festivals in Houston. An online survey, which as of today,
we have over 550 respondents.
Okay, and community feedback sessions. One was held in November, and there is one coming up this Saturday, January 13th. So what was the purpose of this survey, and kind of what has been the results of it?
The overall survey, obviously, I came into my position in November, on November 8th, actually, and this had been in process for quite some time before that. The Board of Directors and Pride had begun looking at the future of the festival and the parade and wanting to grow the festival larger, and realizing that where the current festival was located, that many people on the board felt that it was not possible to grow the festival any larger. So they wanted to get an outside company to perform a task force involving the interviews and the things that you see in front of you on that survey overview, and in order to try to stay as neutral as possible rather than being very emotional in their pitch. They wanted someone from the outside to gather the information, and that's the result of this task force survey.
Mm-hmm. And one of the questions that's before us is changing the date of the parade. Now, traditionally, we have it the last Saturday of a full weekend in the month of June, because we try to hold it as close as we can to the anniversary of the Stonewall Rebellion that took place. It's kind of like, I was born on January 16th, so I celebrate my birthday on January 16th.
Sure.
But people seem to have different ideas about whether continuing to hold it in June was the best idea. So what's up with that?
I think the motivation behind wanting to move it was not necessarily to forget the Stonewall Rebellion, but rather, again, to try to find the best time of year to be able to accommodate the most number of people in growing this festival larger. We were looking at several other locations, including San Diego.
We're going to move the parade to San Diego. Diego?
No. The Houston parade to San Diego.
No, San Diego. I'm teasing.
San Francisco, I think, actually. San Francisco had to move their parade to July because June was their rainy season. Dallas has their festival and parade in September. Several other places around the country have their festivals at different times simply because of the issue of heat or weather-related issues. And in Houston, honestly, we found it very difficult in years past. Again, realizing that I've only come in since November 8th, so I'm just representing the facts as they've been represented to me. But I've been told that we
have. Have you been to the Houston Pride Parade before?
I have been before, and it is hot.
Yeah, how many times?
Twice.
Uh-huh. Well, for some of us who've pretty much been
28 years
from the beginning, we still come out. We still have 100,000 people lining the streets. People come out and do things in the summer.
We do have 100,000 people.
They have the 4th of July celebration for the city holes, and
right,
people come out for that and are all day, and so.
Sure. I think really the task force and the board of directors, their main purpose was to think about growing the festival as a larger event. Actually, in the top 10 festivals in the country, Houston's not even listed as one of the top 10. And although we have 100,000 people lining the streets for the parade, only 5,000 people were in attendance for last year's festival.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about Chicago or Atlanta, who'd bring in $30 million of incremental income on festival day, Houston is nowhere in near comparison or in competition with those other festivals.
We haven't always done a festival, or it's been done as a more low-key event.
This year,
this year was the second year of really pushing it, and it was a fantastic event. And so I think maybe it's just, you know, taking baby steps kind of things.
I agree.
I would like to ask, what dates are y'all thinking about?
I'm actually working with the City of Houston and the Convention and Visitors Bureau. It seems that the last weekend in September would be the most available and the most conducive to the types
of... It's still hot.
It was hot the other day.
Matter of fact, I remember 100-degree weather. In September. Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like Chicago. I just moved here from Chicago, and just before I moved on June 15th, we had 28-degree weather on June 15th, and that's Chicago for you. I think
that's not Houston.
No, one of the things we have to consider.
We haven't had 28 degrees yet.
Well, although we might this weekend.
One of the things we do have to consider is that September could potentially still be hot.
So what brought you to Houston?
I grew up in Houston, moved away when I went to college, and lived overseas for a number of years in my work, and just wanted to come back and put down some roots. My partner and I wanted to move back home.
Uh-huh. And let me just ask a little bit about your background. I meant to do that first. What kinds of things have you been involved in, Jeffrey?
Most of my professional career has been involved in arts and entertainment. I've been a musical director for theater and worked on Broadway and in Chicago. Most recently just finished the national tour of Oklahoma. And
don't burst into song, Jennifer.
You knew I was, didn't you?
You were tempted. I saw
Surrey with a Fringe on Top coming.
Yes.
I also worked extensively in volunteer efforts, particularly in the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, Georgia. I was responsible for recruiting 20,000 volunteers for security efforts at the Olympic Games in Atlanta.
Well, having been one of the organizers for our National March on Washington, I know what that's like to try to do an event like that.
All right. I know we've been talking about location and time. So we're looking. The city is saying the last weekend in September, and we're talking about relocating. But where would you relocate?
The most appealing place has been talking about City Hall, Tranquility Park. A lot of it because of the reason of symbolic things such as being able to hold a mass commitment ceremony on the steps of City Hall, raising the gay flag over City Hall. And from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that one of the beginnings of our movement in Houston was a march against Anita Bryant, and that happened in a downtown location, which
that's true.
Might seem to be returning to the roots of the movement here in Houston. So those have been some of the reasonings behind moving the location, is because of the symbolic nature of using City Hall and really being able to bring more of a public focus and attention to what we're doing.
Okay, now we know last weekend in September in downtown around City Hall. Now, the objections to that, what have been the objections coming back to the Pride?
The objections that we've heard have been across the board, primarily because, honestly, for the last 28 years, the Pride Festival has been here in the Montrose, and this is the traditional area where that parade and festival at least the parade has been located. And because Montrose has been the traditional concentration of gay population here in Houston.
Not necessarily in population of the people that live in the area, because that's the impression, but statistically, it's not as high as in some other zip codes.
Sure.
But it is where a lot of the restaurants and bars and businesses are.
You know, that's been something that I've been having a lot of, especially being a public person in being able to go out and speak to people as a public representative of Pride. A lot of the business owners and stakeholders here in the community are concerned that moving the festival to a downtown location could potentially, and probably would, at first at least, take away a lot of the income potential during that weekend.
Yeah, I think they make more money on that one day than they do over a course of at least half the year. So before we go to the phones to take calls and have people give more community input right now.
Let me give you that number again. It's 713-526-5738, and we had a couple of people who have dropped off.
Well, let me remind you, have your radio tuned down. Someone will answer your call, put it on hold, and then we'll get to you as the calls are queued up. But people can go to what website in order to answer the survey?
It's www.pridehouston.org. And let me also say that the board of directors is considering these changes. And honestly, it could be a combination of both or one or the other. The board could choose to move the location but not the time of year, or vice versa, or neither. That's why we're really encouraging people to attend this community feedback session on Saturday the 13th at 1 o'clock at Resurrection MCC to really let their voices be heard so that the board of directors has an educated vote when they do place their votes.
And that's at 2025 West 11th Street, right at 11th at TC Jester. There is also a meeting this Thursday night at 6:30 p.m. at the Gay and Lesbian Community Center for people who are concerned about the changes that might take place with the parade. I am hoping that the board, the Pride Houston board, will listen to the community in making its decisions.
Let me also say,
because, you know, bigger is not necessarily better, and shouldn't it be about us and for us? I mean, I don't really care that much if people come here from somewhere else. It's our parade. It's for this community.
And honestly, I'm not a voting board member myself, but in the board meetings that I have attended and listened to their concerns, they really want for the entire community to be represented in their decision, because again, this, like you said, Deborah, this is the community's parade. This is the community's festival.
Okay, we have John on the line, and he wants to talk about against the parade being something moved, I guess. John, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and what do you want to say?
I'm sorry, what am I going to say?
Yeah.
You're on the air.
Hello. This is John. I just was calling to, first of all, Mr. Cuellar, welcome back to Houston.
Thank you so much.
I want to congratulate and thank Pride Houston for doing so much to make our parade one of the finest in the world. I know a lot of the credit goes to people like Nick Bryans and others, but no one deserves more credit than the amazing gentleman co-hosting the show tonight, Mr. Valinsky.
Agreed.
I also know that Pride takes its mission seriously and wants to see the parade continue to grow and improve. And I think that's why I was amazed, and really not in a good way, to see the Outsmart article that recently came out that, in essence, seems to make a done deal out of the move of the parade to downtown. You know, I know that in our community here in Houston, we have GLBT people who live in every part of this community, in every zip code and every precinct. But I think there's only one real home that we share, and it never has been downtown. It's always been Montrose, and it always will be. I think to take away an event that means so much to a community, that came from this community, it's grown with this community, it's developed the same character as the community, it reflects the lives of our heroes, people who have lived in this community, who have died in this community. I think to do so would not only be a blunder, I really think it would be arrogant and incredibly disrespectful. I'm really surprised that the Pride Board has done so many studies, and yet this is actually being seriously considered, because, I mean, I meet people all the time in our community. I have hardly met anybody in favor of this potential move. And I just want to leave that with you. I'm kind of angry that I can't be at the meeting on Saturday. I have a long planned trip, but I hope you'll take these concerns to the board. And quite frankly, I hope that people who are opposed to this move will pack that room on Saturday and speak out in opposition to what I think is a horrible idea.
Thank you so much for your comment, John.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Once again, the number is 713-526-5738. If you have a comment about Pride Houston and the parade and the festival and things you'd like to see happen or things you might not want to see happen, 713-526-5738.
Yeah, because we're talking about the potential. Potential. Thank you. Potential move and potential change of date. And what we've talked about, if you weren't listening a few minutes earlier, the possible time would be the last week in September and downtown around City Hall and Tranquility Park.
Okay, and couldn't a lot of the things that are being talked about be done anyway, even if the parade stays in Montrose?
That is also something that has been considered, is that perhaps the festivities, the actual festival itself, could be accommodated in a downtown location and then keep the parade downtown, or keep the parade in the Montrose area. Again, like I said, that the board could go a variety of directions when it does make its vote.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that the list of the challenges and risks are greater at this time than what the proposed benefits are. But let's continue with our callers. I'm going to go to the first caller that's holding. I don't have their name yet. Hello, you're on Queer Voices.
Yes, good evening. How are y'all doing?
Yes, who am I speaking with?
My name is Jeff Cruz.
Jeff,
hi. Jeff.
Hi, how y'all doing tonight?
And what are your feelings about Pride Houston changes?
I would certainly echo the previous caller. I'm very disturbed about the moving of the date and the place of the festival. Primarily, I think this is only the second year that they've done the festival, and I think they need to have a little bit more experience and bringing more attractions and leaving it in our neighborhood. That's where it started, and that's where it needs to be, and bigger is not necessarily better.
Mm-hmm.
One thing too, I'm very downtown. The symbolism. That's all. That's fine, but it's much more about that. It's really about our community, and the Montrose community is changing itself. It is not the gay ghetto that it used to be 20 years ago. So, I mean, I don't think it necessarily has to be moved. It's more of a community. It's more to human scale. We don't need to be surrounded by the 70-story, skyscrapers to feel connection with our community.
Which are empty at that time anyway.
Well, exactly. And one thing, too, one thing I have to pass on, I would encourage, I don't know if the board members or you yourself, Mr. Choir, I was quite impressed. I went to Montreal the summer before last, and they have an incredible, incredible Pride Festival called Diversité. It's always at the end of July. And they're done through the neighborhood and through the streets, and yeah, you're crammed in maybe between, buildings and stuff, but it's in the neighborhood, and that's so I disagree with the foregone conclusion that there's not space in the Montrose area to grow the festival. Of course there is. There's lots of open spaces and stuff to do that. So I think there's a lot of opportunities, and I feel that, they need to be explored further before you move it to downtown.
Thank you for your comments, Jeff.
Yes, thank you, Jeff.
Good night, y'all.
Okay, we have Sally on the line. And just one thing I want to say is, I heard that one of the complaints is the length of the parade. Now, I remember a time when having more people and more floats and more delegations in the parade seemed like a victory, a real plus. So to say it's gotten too big, it's too slow moving or whatever, somebody even said something about maybe taking out some of the smaller groups, which might include the older lesbian group, LOAF, lesbians over age 50, or the transgender group, which is not a large delegation within the parade. So,
or the police department.
Right. I mean, having radio stations and banks and all that, I mean, it's good to see them supporting us, but once again, it's about us. So we're going to go to Sally, and she has a question. Hi, Sally.
Hi.
Well, you had a question about the parade?
I do have a question for Jeffrey. Hi, Jeffrey. It's Sally.
Hi, Sally. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. You had mentioned that the Board of Pride was going to be making their own vote on whether or not they were going to be making the changes. And I do apologize because you may have addressed this when I turned on my radio. I could no longer hear the program. So do you, first of all, do you know when the Pride Committee is going to be making that vote? Is it going to be at an open meeting? Can we attend that meeting as well? Because I'd like to find out when the vote occurs, who votes, and how they vote.
That is an excellent question. All of our board meetings and committee meetings are always open to the public. As of this moment, I don't have an exact date when the board will be voting. A lot of it is in the air because of job-related responsibilities that the board is trying to deal with right now. It will definitely be held sometime towards the end or the end of January or beginning of February.
So the vote is soon, within the next few weeks then?
Yes, after this community feedback session.
Okay.
And actually, I would be happy to make sure that that is published, that those dates are published on our website. And if you would like to get that information, if you would like to send an email to Pride Houston via our website, www.pridehouston.org, I am sure that we would be happy to invite any of the public that would like to attend that vote.
Let us know here on Queer Voices, and we'll announce it also.
Right. Thank you, Sally.
Could I ask one more question?
Sure,
go ahead.
And again, I don't know if you have addressed this, but I've also heard rumors that the nonprofits were going to be consolidated onto one float.
Absolutely not.
Okay. I just wanted to see if that was still an idea being considered, because it is still one of the questions that's being asked in the survey.
We would never ask any individual entity to combine with any other entity unless it was their own choice to do so.
Now, it seems to me maybe all the politicians could be put on one float.
Because they take a...
Some
of them wouldn't want to be seen together.
That's true. But that's their problem, not ours.
Thank you, Sally.
Yeah, thank you for your input.
I think it's very important in regards to Sally's question that we desire to represent the community as a community event. It is not trying to serve any one individual's interests or Pride Houston as an individual interest,
right.
But this is an event for the community, produced by the community, and since Pride is primarily a volunteer oriented organization, we ask that the community get involved and help to shape the future of Pride, not only beyond this vote, but also in years to come.
All right.
Thank you, Sally.
And so just once again, remind people that there will be an open meeting on this Saturday at 1 p.m., even though there's also Martin Luther King Jr. Day parades and marches going on, and we're all going to have to clone ourselves and go to a bunch of different things. And that's going to be at Resurrection Metropolitan Community Church. See, they changed their name. It used to be, we always said MCCR, and now I have to say something different.
Now it's RMCC.
Give the address.
Right. And you can go to the PrideHouston.org website, answer the survey there, and there is another meeting, I think they're calling themselves Keep the Parade in Montrose, that's going to meet at 6:30 at the Community Center at 3400 Montrose on the second floor, Suite 207. So if you're interested in taking part in that, that's an option
as
well.
And where's the Saturday meeting? It's on 11th Street?
11th at TC Jester.
Okay.
Okay, and we have Steve on the line, and he has a comment about the parade. Hello, Steve. You're on the air.
Yes, I was just getting the radio turned off.
Good for you.
Yeah. Like you said earlier, you can't hear. But anyway, that's kind of the point. So, in the past, I guess I want to make one comment from what Sally was asking. Unless the bylaws have changed, you had to have attended two previous meetings before you were allowed to be to vote at any meeting. I think that's still correct, or has that changed?
And you know what? I was co-chair of the Pride Committee for 2 years in a row, and I came up with that so that people couldn't just mass come in and vote over something that had been done by the work of the people already on the committee. It's like you kind of had to earn your place.
Right. I'm not saying that I'm contesting it and saying it's wrong. I'm just saying that people, before they come there, should understand that if they haven't attended two previous meetings, then they don't want, they will be able to speak, but they won't be able to vote.
Well, that's how they get their place on the committee, is if by attending more than one meeting consecutively. But maybe in since this is something of such a huge magnitude, that will need to be looked at, so that the community is the one. It's the people. We are a democracy.
let me speak to that too.
And Jeffrey would like to comment.
The board of directors is actually the group of people that will be voting. They will have the actual vote on this issue. All of the meetings are open to the public, but the public will not have an actual vote according to the board of directors' vote.
Is there a meeting of the board before Saturday?
Not before Saturday, no. But okay. The board will be present at the Saturday meeting.
Okay, and so when is the next meeting of the board?
That is still to be determined.
It's not the regular scheduled time like it has been in the past?
Some of our board members, with the start of a new year, have taken on some new job responsibilities, and so that's going to have to be decided.
So the community may not have an opportunity to attend a board meeting and then also attend another board meeting where they would have a vote.
If you would
before the decision gets made.
If you would like to log onto the website, I will make sure that information is published. Or if you'd like to call into the office at 713-529-6979. That's the Pride office, and
say
I'm there.
Say that number again.
713-529-6979. And my name is Jeffrey, and I'm in the office every day, Monday through Saturday.
Okay, thank you for your comments, Steve.
Well, no, we have a little bit more.
Okay.
Steve, go ahead.
All right. Years ago, when Pride first began, now I'm telling my age, Jack knows me from a long ways back, and Glenn and everybody else does. But anyway, we ended up over at Spock Park.
Right.
And so, you know, to finish the parade up, and... you know, so why can't the parade just do, I mean, I know there's a cost factor here, is just continue itself on down to the Tranquility Park and in there and have that as the end point of the parade.
That's a bit far, but maybe to Eleanor Tinsley up to, we could, the parade could go Westheimer to Montrose and go all the way up Montrose and end at Allen Parkway.
As long as the parade is, they would be there getting there when some of them were still starting.
That's true. And we like
that's
it
true.
That way.
Yes.
That means that
last year we had 120 entrants in the parade.
Good point. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, and we have Larry, and he has a city council comment. Larry?
I can understand it. In my opinion,
you can understand what?
The Houston Council, City Council, a pass for a year on your program, and you're getting what you deserve. You're getting it. You have no idea how drastic they are cutting back on civil liberties in this city, and you're getting it because you're out of touch.
By moving the parade,
they want those cameras on you people. You understand that? They want those government cameras on you, and you just let it pass.
So are you saying that the move downtown would not be good?
Yeah, you might as well vote for Michael Berry.
Okay.
You might as well give him.
Thank you for your comments. Hello?
Hi.
You're on Queer Voices. You have a comment about the Pride Parade?
Yeah, my name is Daniel.
Daniel?
My question was, does the success of the Pride activities necessarily be measured in monetary value?
Absolutely not. If we can break even each year, we consider it a successful year.
Okay. And my second question was, I know there's a separation between, in the gay community, between having Montrose as pretty much the heart of a gay, of the gay community, would actually moving it downtown remove some of the economical benefits that the local businesses rely on during that time.
That definitely is something that we have been discussing and something that needs to be addressed as we go into these community feedback sessions.
Okay.
Thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Okay.
You're on the air.
And this is Donna with a comment.
Yes. There's been a lot of talk about the festival and parade getting larger, and the parade has gotten a lot larger. When I did the online survey, it got me curious, so I went to the Pride Houston website and printed out the lineup of the 2006 Pride Parade, and there were 26 non-gay commercial entries. These are entries that are, I feel like, were just marketing to the gay dollar. And
so you feel like cutting the number of entries, if that's to be done, it shouldn't be done with the community units, but with corporate units?
Right. Well, one of the questions on the survey was very disturbing to me, and that was allowing the smaller organizations to only have a table at the festival instead of having a contingent in the parade. And I think this disenfranchises the very community that we've worked so hard to empower.
Well said.
And as much as I love my Starbucks coffee, seeing Starbucks in the Pride Parade does not instill pride in me as a lesbian-identified woman.
All right. You have any other comment?
Count me against the move.
Okay. Thank you for your comments, Donna.
What about the change in date, Donna?
I think we've already moved the parade to nighttime to deal with some of the heat issues. I think it's real important to stay in touch with our history. So many people have no idea what the Stonewall riots are about. And I'm for keeping the date the same as well as the location. It seems like moving the parade down from Montrose to downtown is going to make it seem to me like just another festival in Houston. And I think we're going to lose the focus. You know, do we want bigger or with a lot of stages, and or do we want to keep the focus on queer pride?
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Donna.
That brings up another subject, and I know J.D. would never forgive me if I didn't bring it up. J.D. is our music aficionado. He does Queer Music Heritage website and brings queer music, and he's also a part of the internationally syndicated This Way Out, where he does audiophile. And we always want to promote preferably queer performers who do openly queer lyrics. And if not openly queer lyrics, at least be queer performers. And then our last choice are straight people that do queer-friendly lyrics. And it seems like here, a lot of times who we have are not so much people from the community, but some, for lack of a better phrase, a queen, or you know, someone like that. Will there be an effort made to be more inclusive of the many outstanding GLBT performers that are out there?
Absolutely, especially since my background is primarily in the entertainment industry. That's something that I would really like to see us focus on more. One of the groups that we are pursuing, we don't have a contract by any means, so please don't misunderstand this, but we are pursuing the gay group Nemesis, who has new reality show on Logo. They're two gay brothers who came out of the Jehovah's Witness movement, and they're rising stars as well. So not only do we get the great entertainment value of having some new rising stars with some interesting dance material, but they're also primarily queer in focus. And I would like to see much more of that happening in our festivals.
Well, it's that time when we have to close out for the evening. I appreciate you very much, Jeffrey, coming with us and talking about what's in store.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Good night.
You have
have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Media consolidation is one of this millennium's emergent issues. What you hear, what you watch, what you have access to online, and ultimately where your dollars go, are all key questions. So join us this January 12th through the 14th with Bill Moyers, Amy Goodman, Jesse Jackson, and Jane Fonda, as well as thousands of others who converge on Memphis, Tennessee at this year's National Conference for Media Reform. I'm Mitch Jezerich with Pacifica Radio, and we're inviting you to this historic event where we'll bring you diverse voices representing the grassroots and beyond, and interviews with people making a difference on an issue that will affect us for generations to come. Again, it's this January 12th through the 14th for Pacifica Radio's coverage of the National Conference for Media Reform.
KPFT will broadcast the Friday morning Bill Moyers opening speech at 10 a.m. We'll also broadcast the Saturday night plenary starting at 8 p.m. and Friday, Saturday, and Sunday hour-long daily updates from the National Conference for Media Reform starting at 7 p.m. KPFT, Houston.
Sunday through Tuesday, January 7th through the 9th, 2007, Earth 101 and Self-Determination will present a historic and provocative radio town hall meeting. This combined programming initiative will continue to explore the earth-shaking topic of the destructive power of religion, which has been addressed on both shows and which solicits continued listener requests to revisit the topic.
This town hall meeting will encompass both shows, but a special show that Monday from 7 to 8 p.m.
Guests include Mr. Ronald Keyes, Mr. Mahdi Muhammad, and special guest Bishop Carlton Pearson, a contemporary heretic who was a fundamentalist evangelical preacher who lost his place in congregation because he stopped believing in hell and began preaching something called the Gospel of Inclusion.
Listen to Self-Determination January the 7th, 2007 from 9 to 11 p.m. and a special program from January 8th, 2007 from 7 to 8 p.m. that Monday, and Tuesday, Earth 101, January the 9th, 2007, from 10 to 11:30 a.m. to participate in revolutionary radio where the topic, the destructive power of religion, is explored in greater detail. It won't be the same without you. I'm Akua Fayette.
I'm OBDK Kamau of Self-Determination.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.